This episode of She Explores is brought to you by Oru Kayak. They design folding kayaks that can go virtually anywhere, thanks to their lightweight and folding design. Stay tuned for later in the episode. We talk again to Stephanie Wright, a member of the She Explores team, about the most magical place she has taken her Oru Kayak so far. I'm Gail Straub, and you're listening to She Explores. This week, we're doing something a little different, sharing an episode of a podcast I admire deeply with you.
I like to describe Out There as exploring big questions through intimate stories in the outdoors.
This is Willow Belden, the host and producer of Out There podcast, and the show is exactly what she said. I'm confident that it's right up your alley. Willow is the real deal. She worked as a reporter at Wyoming Public Radio before starting her show. I chatted with her about how it all came about.
It came about, actually, I had been working at the NPR station in Wyoming, which was, by all accounts, a really good job. I loved my colleagues. I had a great boss. It was work that I thought was meaningful and interesting. And I think a lot of people can relate to this, but I just didn't love it enough. I didn't love it enough to make it worth the amount of stress it was, but I didn't know what I wanted to do instead. And, you know, people would always say, well, what would you rather be doing? And I would say, well, if I knew that, I'd already be doing it. So finally I said, all right, well, I don't know how to figure this out except by taking some time off. So I quit my job and I did a through hike of the Colorado Trail, which goes from Denver to Durango. It's 500 miles. So it's you know, sort of like the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail, but a lot shorter. And so the idea was I was going to go, you know, walk along for 500 miles and think deep thoughts and like figure out my future.
Of course, things didn't go exactly as planned.
I mean, I think anyone who's done through hiking will probably tell you that you don't really think deep thoughts while you're out there. Like you just, I don't know, the trail just consumes your whole focus. So I got to the end of the trail and I was like, wow, I just hiked 500 miles and that was really great. And I still have no idea what I want to do next. But a few days after I got back, I remember very clearly I was sitting in my living room listening to Morning Edition on NPR. And I was just like, I don't want to go back to news reporting, which, I mean, maybe should have been obvious from the get-go, but I think it took like some time away to really be clear about that. And it's okay. So I don't want to go back to news reporting, but I really do still want to tell stories with audio. And I just want to go deeper and I want to look at bigger questions and I want to tell more personal stories. And I had sort of had this idea for an outdoor podcast for a while, but I hadn't had time to really pursue it while I had a full-time job. And now I had nothing on my plate. So I decided to give it a go. And I really wanted it to be, like, I think a lot of outdoor journalism is very much geared toward diehards. Like, you have to be an expert skier to, like, want to read this magazine, or, like, a really hardcore rock climber. And I wanted something different. Like, that kind of journalism has never been as appealing to me as stuff that sort of, like, looks at life a little bit more and looks at social and psychological questions. And so I kind of wanted to tie these sort of bigger picture questions together with stories about the outdoors. And so that's kind of how it came about.
I love how similar our thoughts are around storytelling.
Yeah, right. This is why I think our listeners will like each other's shows.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with you in that, like, the extreme athlete is just, it's fun to think about what you could do and be entertained by those stories, but it's also can be, you know, it's hard when you can't see yourself in the hero or the heroine. So I love that you focus on real people.
Yeah, like I think we're very far removed from like the best athlete. Most of us are, myself included. And so I'm far more interested. I mean, I get pitches for stories all the time from like high-end athletes, PR people, and they're like, do a story about so-and-so. And frankly, those just don't interest me as much. I would much rather hear about, you know, the single mom who leaves behind her kids to go hiking, or, you know, to like fix her emotional problems. Like that's way more interesting to me.
Mm-hmm. Completely agree. So what's challenging about what you do producing out there?
I mean, I think for me, the most challenging part is the business aspect of it, because I started this with a radio background, but with zero business experience. And I was always that person who, like, I never wanted to own my own business. And in fact, I was always that person who was like, oh gosh, I am never going to be a business owner. That sounds awful. Like, why would anyone do this? And I mean, it just sounded like overwhelming and like all of the things that I never wanted to do. And so that's been a real learning curve for me, a steep learning curve for me, figuring out how to market this, how to get listeners, how to handle just all the business aspects of it, how to grow this. It's been hard. At the beginning of this year, I did bring another person on board who's now handling marketing and business for me. And that is such a relief, because now I can focus on content.
What's the most rewarding about making out there?
I mean, I guess there are two things. One is that I've never had a job before that it sounds so cliche, but like I wake up in the morning and I'm like, yeah, I get to go make a podcast. This is awesome. Like it literally like makes me happy doing this. And that's just really lovely. I've never had that in a job before. And which isn't to say I haven't had jobs I've liked, but it's never brought this kind of excitement and enthusiasm. And then I would say the other thing that's really rewarding, when I started the show, one of the things that kind of bugged me was that I wasn't sure if I was contributing to society. It sort of felt like a little pet project, like, oh, let's tell stories about nature. Isn't that quaint? You know, and like, that's fun, but like, really, you should be doing hard-hitting investigative journalism. And like, that's what you would do if you were like a real journalist, you know? And it took a while to sort of realize that this kind of storytelling does contribute to society. It's different, but I mean, getting emails from listeners where, like, I got an email from one listener that just said, out there is my spirit medicine. And I feel like I get a lot of feedback like that, where people are like, you know, this is the calm oasis in like the craziness of life, or like, this particular episode helped me figure out what I'm doing next, or, you know, I just feel like it's helping people on a much more personal level rather than, you know, this big picture, you know, news reporting. And that's really gratifying.
And now, I'm so pleased to present an award-winning episode of Out There called High on Failure. It's all about a woman named Jordan Wirfs-Brock who set out to run a 550-mile race called Infidus in Vermont. I don't want to spoil anything, so I'm offering it out to you with open arms. I hope you enjoy.
Okay, I want to know, what did you think when you first heard about what I was planning on doing? Be completely honest.
Well, on the one hand, I was totally in awe and actually kind of jealous of what you were doing. I kind of wanted to do it too. But on the other hand, I also thought you were insane, like completely and utterly insane.
Yeah, I get that a lot. And to be honest, I actually agree with you part of the time. I think I'm insane a bit. So fair enough.
This is Jordan Wirfs-Brock. She's a journalist in Colorado. And when she's not reporting, she's also a runner. A really hardcore runner. Today, she's going to share the story of a race she did last spring. It takes place in the mountains of Vermont, and it's one of the most challenging trail running races that's ever been put on. 888 kilometers. That's 550 miles if you're rusty on the metric system.
The race is called Infinitus, but in my head, I call it Infinitus, like an inflammation in your infinity gland.
Okay, so before we hear your story, a race this long is so far outside the realm of comprehension for most of us. how does this even work? I mean, do you just start running and then stop 550 miles later?
Pretty much, yeah. It's on a 26-mile course that's shaped like a figure eight, and you run that loop over and over and over. Basically, you're doing a bunch of laps.
And to put this in perspective, each lap is the length of a whole marathon.
Yeah, that's right.
So is there a time limit? I mean, I've never run 550 miles. How long does that take?
Once the race starts, you have 10 days to finish the full 888 kilometers. You can take a break and sleep or eat whenever you need to, but the clock never stops.
So stop to sleep and eat. How does that work? Do you camp out?
Not exactly. There's a ski lodge where people could go in and sleep. People also had RVs and trailers that they could sleep in. And you're typically sleeping somewhere between 4 and 6 hours a night.
So how did you train for this? I mean, for shorter races, you can run the distance that the race is going to be ahead of time. But for something like this, how do you prepare?
Yeah, so I had a training plan. I didn't always follow it, but basically it included a lot of long and lonely runs. Like, there was one time when I got home from work on a Friday night and I started running at 7 p.m. and I didn't stop until 7 p.m. the next day. Here's a clip from my audio diary. Okay, so I am about to start my 24-hour training run in a few minutes here. Actually, what I'm doing at this very instant is putting something called anti-monkey butt powder into my shoes. I've never used, I just put it down on the ground and it splooshed up at me. I've never used powders like this. You have to experiment a lot with everything, food, shoes, other products, and it's the only way to really find out what works. Anyway, later that night, the wind right now, it's absolutely ridiculous. It is just whipping past me, taking all my heat away. It's taking a lot of energy. It's not very fun. But other than the wind, things are great. I sounded a lot worse by the end, but that was kind of the point, to get used to being miserable and lonely. Really, though, Infinitus is so different than anything I've ever done. It's a step into the unknown, not just for me, but for all of the racers doing it. This was the first time the race had ever been held, and there'd been things that were similar, but never anything quite like this. For example, there are six-day races, but you're running around a track, a quarter-mile or a one-mile loop, not out in the woods, out on trails. So really, we were all kind of making it up as we went along.
So one more question, and this kind of goes back to the part about you possibly being insane. Why? Why did you decide to do this race?
Yeah, I get that question a lot, and I'll talk about it more in a minute. But I think I did this race because I was searching for my breaking point.
So, spoiler alert, Jordan did find her breaking point. She failed, didn't manage to finish the race. But unlike so many failures, which leave us feeling defeated, Jordan's failure actually ended up being a good thing. In fact, she says it's one of the best things that's ever happened to her. I'll let her take it from here.
My journey to Infinitus began where most idiotic/brilliant ideas do, over beers with friends. I just returned from what seemed the pinnacle of insanity, a race called Fat Dog, 120 miles and 29,000 vertical feet of gain in the mountains of Canada. After running for 34 hours straight, I crossed the finish line with a big, stupid grin on my face. It felt great. I felt like I was just getting started. I'd done a few other 100-milers, but they were different. In those other races, the last few miles, it was like I was dragging my own carcass. I typically finished on the verge of tears. There's a lot of crying in ultra running. But after Fat Dog, I felt like I was finally getting the hang of this ultra long distance thing. Like, my body and brain were adapting to this crazy sport. And I was curious, how far could I go? See, for me, running has always been this way to turn the impossible into the possible. It's thrilling to complete the longest run of your life. The first time I ran 9 miles, I was still in high school. It was in the Columbia River Gorge at sunset, and I felt like a superhero. I wanted that feeling again, so I chased it. Through a half marathon, a full marathon, 50 miles, 100. Each time, it's terrifying. You don't know whether you can do it. But when you do succeed, something that used to be scary, unattainable, downright bananas, becomes real. Even becomes normal. So when my friend Greg suggested a 500-plus mile mountain trail race, I already knew I was in. Besides, it's easy to say yes to something that's nearly 9 months away. From the moment I decided to run Infinitus, I knew I wanted to document it. So in my head, I wrote and rewrote the script of how it would end. I pictured three scenarios. First, a triumphant victory. Not only would I finish the full 888K, but I would win. And I'd show the world that if the distance is long enough, the challenge tough enough, a woman can and will best the men. Or I would make a heartbreaking departure from the race via ambulance, rushed off to the ER for kidney failure or flesh-eating bacteria or some other life-threatening injury. Or, and here's what I thought was most likely, after all chances of completing the full 888K had slipped away, I'd slog on to the last second, fighting to the end even when all hope is lost. None of these things happened. The real end is weirder and better. I failed. On day 7 out of 10, mile 377 out of 551, I broke. But let's go back to the beginning. The race was in late May, when my mom and I drove up from Boston. Vermont's rolling green hills seemed gentle, inviting. The trunk of our rental car was full of yogurt, baby wipes, chocolate, ibuprofen, 6 pairs of running shoes, and too many socks to count. I unpacked my stuff in a cross-country ski lodge that was our home base. And when I say lodge, it's really more of a barn with a loft and old wooden skis and snowshoes hanging on the walls, and plumbing that only works for part of the year. It was there, the night before the race, that I first met race director Andy Weinberg.
Yes, I think you're crazy. I have to be honest with you. We were kind of kidding. We didn't really think you'd show up.
Andy is the grand architect of the pain and glory behind Infinitus. And it's not just me he's calling crazy. It's all 10 of us who showed up to compete. Andy is known for putting on events that push people to their limits. And he designed this race to be next to impossible.
So you want to break us?
Not necessarily. I actually want you to succeed. I'm sure you'll be broken a number of times throughout the event, but that's part of the fun for us.
He explained that our world was about to shrink down to a 26-mile stretch of trail that would be our home for the next 240 hours.
We're going to start at 8:08 in the morning, and you guys are just going to run for 10 days. And Sunday morning, not this Sunday, but the following Sunday at 8:08, the race is over.
Andy had sent us all an email 2 days before the race saying that the course had changed. Rumor had it that a deranged moose with a brain parasite was terrorizing part of the original trail. So he described the new route, a smushed, lopsided figure eight, with the lodge at the center. We are going to run this course 20 and a half times.
You're going to be on a dirt road, and you're going to drop down to Silver Lake, also beautiful. You'll take the Lester Hollow Trail, 4.5 miles, flat and runnable. Then you'll climb Chandler Ridge, and you'll come back around Silver Lake, and then you'll do the 3 miles back.
We'd be running on snowmobile trails, narrow footpaths, and some short stretches of dirt roads. He told us about a big black dog who lives on the course who might follow us. Andy assured us the dog was friendly. And then we were off.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
All right.
my plan was to go out easier than easy. Walk as much as I wanted, stay relaxed. And I did. We started out on the upper portion of the figure eight. This 10-mile loop had a steep climb up Mount Romance, then a sweet downhill cruise back to the lodge. When I came through base camp, I felt great. I was in and out, onto the lower part of the figure eight. I kept feeling good even as the trail got tougher. This 16-mile section included a slog through a marsh with shoe-sucking mud, and a winding ridgetop trail that felt like going around and around in circles. I have to hand it to Vermont. I live in Colorado, where I'm used to running on rugged, high-altitude trails in the Rocky Mountains. So I didn't expect the trails to be that hard. But they were gnarly. Rocks, roots, mud, logs to climb over, ankle-deep fallen leaves on the ground so you couldn't even see your footing. I got lost on my way back and ran a bonus mile or two. But even that didn't dampen my mood. One marathon down, 19 and a half to go. Every time I came past the ski lodge, I had this system where my crew would check in with me. My crew included my mom, of course, and a bunch of friends who later came to help out. They asked me to rank how I was feeling, physically and emotionally, on a scale of 1 to 10.
I'm going to do a quick survey here.
Pain is 1, just my hip is a little tight.
Okay.
Mood is good.
What's that, 8 or 9?
They also wrote down how much I ate, drank, and peed.
So you're going to take your sandwiches, or are you going to take your... You need to get a little more calories, I think, so you don't get tired.
I have plenty.
Did you hear that, how I ignored my mom when she tried to get me to eat? Obviously a bad idea, but I was caught up in the rhythm of the race. Things went like clockwork for the first day. My pace was great. I was clicking loops off. We recorded our progress on this big cardboard sign in the ski lodge. It had the names of the 10 racers and a row of boxes. Every time we got back from a loop, we'd take a black Sharpie and draw a circle next to our name in a box. 2 circles per box, one for the top of the figure eight, one for the bottom. Fill 20 and a half boxes and we'd be done. Simple. Around 1 a.m. after 17 hours and 2.5 marathons, I stopped to sleep. My legs felt like lead. My body obviously needed a rest, and yet I couldn't really sleep. I'd doze for a few minutes and then wake up sweating and feverish.
Find out what happens next after a word from our sponsor, Oru Kayak.
Mostly, I use my Oru Kayak around Seattle. We have a lot of alpine lakes, and I live next to Green Lake. It's a city lake, and they're super easy to take there just after work or on the weekends.
The folks at Oru Kayak believe that connecting to nature is a deep human need, even for those of us who live in cities. Last episode, we talked to Stephanie Wright about how the Oru Kayak helps her experience nature while living in urban Seattle. This time, she told me about escaping to Big Bend National Park with her friends.
But the most epic place I've definitely taken my kayak is Big Bend National Park down in Texas. And the park is very deserted and isolated, and it's kind of hard to get to in general. But one of the more isolated parts is Boquillas Canyon and Santa Elena Canyon. And so we spent 3 days kayaking down the canyon on the very murky, muddy waters with these huge canyon walls on either side of us. It felt like we were going through a sleeping giant. It was just humongous, and the water was so calm and it was quiet, and it was so nice to get away and get out there and be away from cell service. And we could pack our kayaks full of tents and food and drinks and everything that we needed for the next 3 days. It was really awesome to get to spend that time with my friends.
Get off the grid in a beautiful, foldable Oru Kayak. Learn more at www.orukayak.com. That's www.orukayak.com. Mm-hmm.
reality set in after that first sleepless night. The next morning, back on the trail, my mom met me at the top of the swamp, which I'd come to call the swamp of misery. She brought me a pair of dry shoes and asked me how things were going.
How you doing, Jordan?
Not good. Pretty much can only walk.
You're doing, you look pretty strong coming up here. Walking is fine.
You know, I have to maintain a certain pace for my conversion time.
My quads were totally useless, and I was pissed off. How, after all my training, was I bonking this early? I felt awful. But I didn't want to get off schedule, so I just kept forcing myself to move. And for a while, it worked. I started to feel better.
Now that is a beautiful noise.
The pack I carried has these water bottles. They slosh around and make a lot of noise, but only when I run, not when I walk. Usually I find it really annoying, but this time it was a welcome noise to hear.
And just a few hours ago, I thought I was not going to run again. For the next 8 days, my quads were totally dead, and I had to walk the last 17 miles or so. But whether it's ibuprofen, the walk break, who knows? But here I am, running again, and a real run, not just the ultra shuffle. There's a light drizzle right now, but it's sunny on the mountains on the horizon. Gorgeous.
Going pretty well by day three. Even though I wasn't eating enough, I was ahead of pace, had earned myself a bit of a buffer. Sure, things were hard, but at this point I was feeling optimistic, in control. Unfortunately, that nice, confident feeling didn't last long. My mom drove out to meet me at the top of the swamp at 5 a.m. with a pair of dry shoes and socks, like she always did. But this time she brought something else, too. News. Bad news.
So you now know that there are 21 laps required, not 20 and a half.
What?
He didn't tell you, but...
What the f***?
Okay, so
I did not know
I need to tell you that.
You heard that right. They added an extra 16 miles to the race. This seems like a minor thing in an event this long, and if my head had been in the right place, I would have seen that. But I was stressed about every little thing. So I freaked. I was also really mad that Andy didn't tell me himself, that I had to hear it secondhand. But I had no choice. I just carried on.
Do you want a sip of coffee?
Yeah.
All right. You're gonna do great. Bye.
When people hear about Infinitus, they often remark how boring it must be to travel the same trail over and over day after day. But it's not boredom that's tough. It's loneliness. Later that night...
It's not even that anything is, like...
Hurting
or I'm that tired. I'm just, like...
It's your mental head, yeah. So
I'm not looking forward to being alone for the next 4.5 hours in the dark.
I wasn't joking about there being a lot of crying in this sport. My friend Greg, the one who got me into this mess, his dad, Doug, was helping out at the race. And Doug was at the top of the swamp as I passed by.
If you go slow enough, I'll walk with you.
Seriously?
But you gotta go slow enough.
How slow? I'm walking pretty slow.
Okay.
Nicest guy ever, right? I perked up instantly, felt this surge of energy.
And are you a talker?
Normally.
That's good, because I'm more of a listener than a talker.
And we set off together into the dark woods. Not being alone made me feel excited, suddenly capable again. The next day, some friends arrived to join my crew. My friend Vicky even ran with me. And as we ran, we chatted about ex-boyfriends and plotted future running adventures. When I hit rough patches, Vicky blasted 90s music from her phone to distract me. We also discussed, at length, who would play us in the film adaptation of Infinitus. I definitely call dibs on Jennifer Lawrence. My mom is totally Sigourney Weaver. We couldn't decide whether Andy, the race director, would be a sinister Brad Pitt or an Ed Harris type. Joking aside, I had a problem. A big problem. I was basically starving. I had miscalculated how many calories were in my powdered drink mix. Once I was in the hole, calorie-wise, it just kept getting worse. Remember how my mom kept trying to get me to eat and all I did was ignore her and nibble? Oddly, that's what happens when you're accidentally starving yourself. Food becomes really, really unappetizing. Normally, I love to eat, but now everything turned my stomach and chewing was this huge chore. I should have been eating 8 to 10,000 calories a day, but was probably only getting 3,000. In other words, even though I was running more than 50 miles a day, I wasn't eating much more than I'd need on a sedentary day at work. As a result, my muscles felt lifeless and empty. Even a slow pace made me run out of steam. Yeah, I know. Clueless. But that's what stress does. It gives you blinders. We did finally solve the problem. After several days of struggling to choke down solid food, my crew handed me something I could stomach. Ensure and other nutrient-dense meals in a can, or as my friend Vicky called them,
power shake.
Another thing that worked? My friend Sarah bummed a stick of butter off another runner, melted it into a bowl of lentil soup, and added some peanut butter. I finished the whole bowl off and immediately asked for more.
Jordan would like you to buy.
My boyfriend Ben was on his way to Infinitus, and Sarah was writing him an email asking him to pick up groceries.
Butter. Okay.
Olive oil.
V8 juice. Orange juice. Maybe more protein shakes.
That goes on the list. Like, so many protein shakes.
I'm writing literally that. So many protein shakes.
We also made sure to stock up on things that are full of fat.
How do you feel about cheese?
Smile! I feel great. We decided, Vicky and I had a whole plan. We talked about all the stuff we're going to do. We're just going to, like, ask Ben to buy sticks of butter and just, like, melt it over everything. Because I need more calories.
Just so you know, in regular life, I don't sit around eating giant bowls of butter and cheese. But you absolutely need to eat fat, sugar, and salt during a race like this. Lots of it. And so butter and cheese it was. By this point, I knew the course turn for turn, even in the dark. I was starting to recognize individual rocks and trees, even give them names in my head. But every day, the course changed.
The swamp of misery was extra miserable this morning.
And yet, I actually learned to love that swamp. And the rest of the course, too. After a rainstorm, hundreds of tiny orange salamanders appeared on the trail. Stinging nettles sprang up overnight, and I met two guys with buckets heading down to harvest them to make salad. And then the not-so-natural wonders started appearing. I think first I noticed the doll heads stuck inside mason jars on the side of the trail. Yeah, doll heads. The size of apples. Severed from baby dolls. 8 of them, all in a row. And then there were the toy handcuffs, also 8 of them, on a bridge. They kept popping up. 8 rubber duckies and 8 squirt guns. 8 pairs of tidy whiteys. and a life-size stuffed clown dangling by its foot from a branch at the top of Mount Romance. It was creepy, but at least it meant you were done with the climb. Well, until the next time, of course. I later found out that the co-race director, Jack, was responsible, although at the time he staunchly denied it. The days and loops piled up. I ran through snow, I ran through 88 degree heat, which made my heart race like a gerbil's and wreaked havoc on my GI tract. When I was feeling particularly awful, I listened to some audio messages that my friends had sent me, like this one.
Hey, future Jordan, it's past Helen. Yeah, I have no idea how f***ing long you've been running at this point, and I have no idea how much left you have to do or how you feel, but it's actually just really inspirational to me that you decided to do this in the first place. Seeing you do these ultra marathons, it's a reminder that we can do stuff that, you know, our body maybe doesn't always want to do. And I feel like it's really helped me do more hiking. And also, totally separately from that, you're f***ing running so far. It's completely insane. And just the fact that your mind, that you decided to do that is really cool. I feel like I know someone who's in the Olympics, but it's way cooler. It's actually way cooler than that.
Another friend told me that I was like an astronaut, experiencing something few people ever will and putting untapped human potential to good use. Running can feel solitary, even selfish. So hearing that what I was doing inspired people, got them to go outside, gave them strength when they were having a rough time, it felt like I was running for something bigger than myself. It felt like they were there with me. These messages really helped get me back out on the trail, and of course, they made me cry. Finally, nearly a week in, I was starting to get this race under control. I started to eat, really eat, 10,000 calories a day like I was supposed to. When your body is working properly in a race like this, you can return from running a marathon, how's a giant burrito or entire pizza in a few minutes and just keep running. No sloshy stomach or burping or anything. It felt like I had a brand new body. I felt great, like the race had started over. Of course, there's always another problem to solve. Like my feet got bruised and then so swollen they wouldn't even fit into my shoes. So I borrowed a larger pair and padded them with rolled up socks. The pain made me feel lightheaded, but I kept moving, even if sometimes moving meant sitting on a rock every 50 feet to cry or fix my shoes or both. On day 6, Ben, my boyfriend, was with me on the 16-mile loop. We were almost back, 3 miles from the ski lodge, at the top of the Swamp of Misery when... I can't really call it rain because it didn't come down in drops, just waves of water. The trail turned into a river. It was so dark, some of the other runners had their headlamps on in the middle of the afternoon. Lightning was crashing all around us, so close it felt like we were in one of those Faraday cages. I was screaming. Lightning is one of my biggest fears, right behind mountain lions and failure. Ben pulled me to the side of the trail, and we squatted under a tree as he told me to slow down, to breathe. You know what I yelled back? I am calm! But then something snapped. I stopped screaming and started singing instead, making up lyrics about whatever I saw. Logs, ferns, the rusty oil drum by the side of the trail. And sorry you don't get to hear my improv solo. I didn't have my recorder with me. I sang right up to the door of the ski lodge, where Vicky met me with the most delicious lukewarm cup of coffee ever. The next morning, day 7, I was up before the sun. My feet looked like feet again, and I was wearing shoes that actually fit. Here I was, kind of in a routine. I'd run head-on into a problem, not eating, not sleeping, my swollen feet, the crazy weather, cramped muscles. And then, with the help of my crew, the other racers, the race staff, we'd figure out how to solve it. Writing out problem after problem wasn't smooth or easy, but it was forward progress. I was feeling tentatively optimistic, like I was actually going to pull this crazy thing off. Then something happened that I couldn't bounce back from. On lap 14 and a half, I was by myself in the dark, running down the backside of Mount Romance. My Achilles tendon had been nagging me since day two, but we taped it and got on with it. Now, all at once, it flared up. Bad. It was like someone was grabbing me by the ankle with vice grips and jabbing a knife into the back of my leg. Dull and sharp at the same time. Every step made me gasp. I should have slowed down, walked, stretched, but I stubbornly kept running, maybe in a desperate attempt to prove to myself that I was okay. I wasn't. I limped into the ski lodge like a wounded animal, stoically marked that loop on the cardboard chart, walked over to my crew, and then...
I pushed her so much. I know, but I want to be done.
You gotta lean back.
I fell apart.
Why is my nose bleeding? Like, what? I can't believe that my nose is bleeding. Like, what?
At this point, I was lying on the floor, my foot in a bucket of ice, a wad of tissue shoved up my nose. I'd been through a string of painful, ridiculous things, but this was different. It was clear in that moment that I wasn't going to finish the race. It wasn't just that I couldn't run. I couldn't walk either. I felt everything all at once. Frustrated, helpless, angry, confused. And yeah, part of me was even relieved. Mostly, though, I was overwhelmed. I didn't quite know how to process it yet. Every time I saw someone head out the door to run, I felt a twinge of jealousy. Because I didn't know my last loop was going to be my last loop, it was like I didn't get a chance to properly say goodbye to the trail. I had this silly hope that maybe I'd be able to keep walking, could crutch my way around the course or something. The next day, I iced and taped my foot, but my ankles looked like puffy pink logs, and I could barely put any weight on my Achilles. It was clear I wasn't going to be logging any more miles. I felt like my body and brain had conspired against me, teamed up to take the decision to quit out of my control. If you'd asked me before Infinitus what I would have done in this situation, I would have told you that I'd leave, just pack up and go home, that I'd be too upset, that it would hurt too much to see other people keep going when I couldn't. But that's not what happened. I stayed. After all I'd been through, that ski lodge, that trail, they'd become my home. And the other amazing, brilliant idiots who started this journey with me became my weird, crazy running family. Leaving before the end of the race was out of the question. The evening of my injury, new runners were arriving at our tiny village of running lunatics. You know how marathons often have 10Ks or 5Ks so that more people can participate? Well, Infinitus had shorter races too. A 72-hour, a 48-hour, and a 24-hour race. Even an 8K. People started flooding the ski lodge for those shorter races. And when they began running, they faced problems, just like I had. I was in the ski lodge icing my ankle when I saw this woman sitting with her head in her hands. So I went over and talked to her. Brought her a cookie. Gave her a hug. I was moved by her determination, and I wanted to see her and all the other runners succeed. Over the next 3 days, I helped them. I heated up frozen lasagna for them, popped their blisters, lent them my shoes and my raincoat. After being on the receiving end of kindness from my mom, my friends, and people I just met, I got to pay it back. I got to see what it's like on the other end of a crazy race. And I got to watch my mom start the 8K race. There was a much bigger crowd there than at the start of the 888K. And instead of the silly little air horn they had for us, the 8K runners got. Yes, a cannon. And I got to give my mom a muddy, sweaty hug when she finished. I also got to watch my buddy Greg set off on his final lap, sparkler in hand. Out of the 10 of us who started the 888K, he's the only one who finished in an uncanny 8.88 days. Being on the other side, cheering and helping racers, was fulfilling. But Infinitus left me with something even better. Before the race, failure seemed like the worst thing in the world. Worse than lightning. But when I failed, spectacularly, publicly, it was actually not so bad. It was like I had been building up this hard, heavy shell of stress. And when my body broke, the stress broke away too. Some of my friends told me that right after Infinitus, I sounded like I was on drugs. Little things like wiggling my toes and walking in a light breeze. These felt like new experiences. I started having more conversations with strangers. Things that otherwise would have stressed me out, like losing my wallet, seemed manageable. Almost fun. I was kind of high on failing. Here's why. I had been approaching Infinitus and everything, really, like this fly caught in a jar. In running and in work, relationships, life, I'd seek out the hardest path, then try to brute force my way through. When problems came up, like my calorie deficiency in Infinitus, instead of stopping to figure them out, I'd muscle on. I'd slam myself against the glass, head down, full speed, again and again and again. I thought that was the only way to get out, to break the glass. And getting that injury sent me tumbling to the bottom of the jar. Now, lying flat on my back, I could finally look up and see that the lid wasn't even screwed on. All I had to do was slow down and climb right out.
That was Jordan Werfsbrock. She's a data journalist with Inside Energy, based in Denver, Colorado. You can check out more of her work at insideenergy.org and find her on Twitter at JordanWB.
Before the Out There credits roll, thanks to Willow for collaborating and sharing her story on She Explores. You can find Out There on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you stream stories. This week, you can re-listen to our interview with Rahawa Hale, Small Beauty on the Appalachian Trail. Learn more at www.outtherepodcast.com. And you can find She Explores in all the same places, as well as she-explores.com and our new She Explores podcast Facebook group. If you like listening, share us with a friend or rate us on Apple Podcasts. It helps us to find new listeners. Thanks again to our sponsor, Oru Kayak. Music is also by Mind's Eye and Soft and Furious. Till next week.
A big thank you to Jordan's crew, who not only helped her through the dark moments of the race, but also recorded a lot of the audio you heard in this story. Her crew included Rebecca Werfsbrock, Sarah Newman, Lucas Fedowski, Ben Zeiger, and Vicky Patrician. Also, thank you to Dan Boyce and Caitlin Pierce for production help and feedback.